All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Action for Everyone for this here January 16th, 2022. As always, I am joined by the Skylines motherfucker, Liam O'Donnell. Liam, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. I'm the heel of the podcast, but feeling really great about the reception to our amazing poster from Julian Rico Jr.
I'm gonna, your guest is going to chime in just to say, Jesus fucking Christ, that poster.
We can get into that, but this is, so obviously we have Jordan Cruciola, who Hi. My clout chasing ass is always wanting to do podcasts with her. She's actually one of the first people I thought of when I was thinking of this, but she's got roughly like 200 podcasts that she hosts. And I thought she was just way too cool to
I'm here anytime. Yeah. That bat signal goes up, I'm ready.
Yeah, you're like the you know, like the Steve Martin host from SNL. Like you'll be our reoccurring guest whenever you are available.
I mean, gorgeous, gorgeous girls appear on the Action for Everyone podcast. Gorgeous, gorgeous girls host the Action for Everyone podcast. So good job, you guys.
Take my spot. Shit.
Yeah, I was gonna say we'll bring in the star of the poster, Mr. Vice Victus. How are you doing, Vice?
I'm doing great. I'm in great company. More so now today. It's always a good time to be here.
Do you actually have a predator tattoo on you, or was that improv for the poster? Because it was a really good idea if it was improv, and it's a really cool tattoo if you have one.
I have a self-mutilation guilt scar that one day I'll talk about.
Okay. So
that's a story for another time.
Gotcha.
But just, which is to say, I don't have traditional tattoos per se.
Gotcha.
But I have wounds on the inside and outside.
I want you to know existentially, you seem like somebody who would have a kick-ass predator tattoo.
Yes.
Existentially, that seems like a cool choice you would make.
We're going to start a GoFundMe to get that tattoo on his body.
It wouldn't be the predator. It would be a predator as in an MQ-9 drone predator in my case, which is probably even more fucked up than the actual monster. But again, this is the deeper wounds that we will share over time.
What a tease. Wow. I'm so ready for the sequel of this franchise.
No, you're not.
All right. Yeah. And as we mentioned, as Jordan brought up the poster, Julian, thank you so much for that. Everybody has been really warm. And just so everybody does know, the reception has been such, we are looking into t-shirts and posters and stuff like that. We will have them available. I sent the boys kind of a mock-up of one the other day that I was just screwing around with when I should have been working, and they'll be available. I don't necessarily want to say soon, but soon-ish. We'll call it.
I don't know who you're looking through for, you know, possible poster stuff, but VG Kids is an incredible print shop that does a number of the limited run press things that I have. Their paper is amazing. Their colors are amazing. So I'm just saying, like, if you want to talk about it, I do a lot of print purchasing.
Good to know. And we will certainly be talking about it.
I think I have 24 framed posters in my room. That's just the framed ones. It's the walls. It's the floors now. As soon it's going to be above the windows to fit the, like, a little slew of guys that I have. It's full obsession. It's a full
obsession. Well, you better clear out some space for us, because we deserve, you know, to be displayed in a place of pride in every
I'm
home
saying,
of every
I'm
action
saying.
Fan.
Absolutely.
You likewise better clear out some space there, Liam. I see your posters. I want to see us front and center on that wall.
Oh, yeah. I could just slip it right in front of that Skyline one. No problem.
I do want to shout out on the wall behind Liam, because he does have posters, and obviously Skyline is there. But you know what else is there? The Bay. The fucking Bay. And that movie scared the shit out of me. I am the mark for found footage movies. That stuff scares me so much. That one, I was like, this is a roller coaster ride. Don't let me off. This is outstanding good time. So it is,
well, thank you. All I did on that was say, I think we should help them with the VFX. And they said, this man gets a co-producing credit. But it is strategically hidden behind the door, because the kids always look at it and go, oh, because it's got this nasty parasite inside of a skull. So But yeah, that's why it's specifically in that spot, so they don't have to stare at it when they come in the room.
All right, so let's go to the first topic of the day. And Jordan, we will give you a chance to, you know, plug all your stuff towards the end.
I'll keep it as brief as possible.
I know it's going to take 45 minutes, Jesus. So we'll save
it for the end. One day I'm going to monetize all of them.
When you figure that out, please let me know.
Yeah, right. I'll let you know.
All right. So first thing up, we did get a trailer this week. We got a couple trailers this week that I feel like we need to talk about. The first one is a movie that I was unaware has kind of been on the shelf for a little bit, but it is finally getting a U.S. release here in March. And that is Invincible, starring the great, great Johnny Strong and the great, great Marco Zaror. So let's go with Vice. First, what'd you think of the Invincible trailer?
Oh, man. So that's just the kind of stuff you want from. Well, first of all, these guys, Johnny Strong and Marco, they look fantastic. Like, movement wise, as you know, martial artists, and also their age, they're like upwards of their 40s or whatever. But they look terrific. Like, it's just beautiful. You love seeing beautiful men beat the shit out of each other. It's like it's
oh, my God. You're so right. 100%. Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a fetish, more like a need. I don't know. Hard to say.
Yeah. Oh, a criteria for you.
Yeah, yeah.
A part of your wellness regimen. Self-care.
Like moisturizing,
yeah. Yeah, self-care. Vice just watching these movies and moisturizing on the couch, just being so just.
Is that what
we're
calling it? Moisturizing on the couch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A4E vernacular.
Oh man, she got me ready. It was like the first moment she got me good. the only thing I want to say is I think maybe some people, even who are deep into action movies, aren't as familiar with Johnny Strong as they should be, which is fair because
I'm literally looking at his IMDb right now, and I can't believe he's the dude from the first Fast and Furious. I was like,
yeah, you know, and to be fair, I first remember him from Black Hawk Down. He was one of the he portrayed one of the several people, the special force snipers who died in real life. He played Randy Shugarth, so you know he's one of the guys when they capture or they're rescuing the pilot, and it's just two of them versus like hundreds of guys. He's one of those guys doing those snipers. So I remember him. I remember the performance from so long ago. It's always stuck with me, and I think maybe my favorite though of his is I think people might be more familiar with this is Sinners and Saints. He's kind of like it's like a NOLA like gritty cop movie. It's like a gritty urban cop the movie, you know, that kind of thing. But it's, you know, it's just really, really well done. But yeah, he's a great presence, great performer. But you know, I think he's really gotten his due, and I hope that, you know, this is one that will get him to that level. And of course, with Marco Zaror, you know, what needs to be said, you know, one of the finest working film martial artists today. But again, that I don't think people give him credit. Most people know, most of our audience knows him from Undisputed 3. He's the main villain, Dolor. And you know, and I guess the big, even though there's a Undisputed 4, Boyka, I think that most people, I think that part 4 should have been Zaror's movie. Or, you know, it's keeping with the theme of the Undisputed, where the villain of the previous film becomes the protagonist of the new film. That would have been a phenomenal entry, from, you know, in my eyes. But, you know, whatever. We love Atkins, and, you know, book is great. So, you know, that's what the universe wanted. But, you know, it's still, that would have been a great, you know, what if that
the neighboring happened. Universe where that happens is also a good one, though. I think that's right. A very good point.
You could have had
that
both.
That's a very good point.
Could have had both.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, so, again, it's good to see both of them together, both of them again. And now together, and this looks like really, like, again, in the trailer itself, the action looks really solid, like really, really, really like tight and sharp. So I'm looking forward to this.
The thing I want to say about Johnny Strong that I love about him so much is the way he moves physically, he is such an interesting actor to watch, because unlike a lot of martial arts stars, he moves with such conservation of energy. It's hard to explain.
An efficient man, efficient star.
Yeah, very, very much so. Like his action scenes, you know, our good friend, action Twitter tactical expert Chris Barreras considers Sinners and Saints to be, you know, one of the greatest tactical movies ever, and Johnny Strong to be one of the greatest tactical actors. He moves with an efficiency and a purpose that a lot of other actors don't. So I always find him just absolutely fascinating to watch on screen, because there's not a wasted ounce of energy in anything he does, which isn't to say he's being lazy. He's quite the opposite. He's working his ass off. He's just, it's very focused. Jordan, what did you think of the trailer?
This is exactly the trailer I want to see for what I feel like this brand of movie is going to deliver. I thought the trailer was really excitingly done. I was like, this is how, because I feel like there is a hurdle in some people's minds, I think, to get past with like the landscape of DTV action to access that, like, it's not necessarily going to look like slickness wise, like the movies that you're used to, the ones where you look and you're like, oh, everything's the same. It's like, well, you just don't watch enough. And I think that this move, like watching something like this is like, yeah. So like, guys, I know that you might have some sort of like stopping points in your head for like, oh, this feels, I don't know, this feels a little ham-fisted. Maybe this feels like a little corny to you. And it's just, I want people to recalibrate their brains to like click over into that more contextually appropriate mode if they're served a trailer like this, to be like, I can immediately find the enticing and the good about what this brand of movie is going to deliver. And like, it's like, hey, this trailer has that synced up punches and percussion thing, just like in like Henry Cavill loading his fists up in the Mission Impossible trailer. Like, this can satisfy those same like cravings in you for the spectacle action cinema you crave, but it's just going to be at a more like intimate, like fist to fist level. So I really enjoyed this trailer. And, you know, it's been said about the guys who star in it. I'm really looking forward to this one.
Liam.
Yeah, no, I thought that was really well said, Jordan. And you know, it's basically another version of Universal Soldier. I can take as many of those as you want to serve up.
100%.
So keep going.
Yep.
Yeah,
and like I said, it has sat on the shelf. It was actually filmed in 2020. I had some people on Twitter telling me it was actually even on Tubi for a while. Probably an illegal upload on either Tubi or Prime would be my
wait. Favorite. You can just illegally upload movies to Tubi?
I was just gonna say, like, wait, what's the source of Tubi movies?
Well,
is this the Wild Wild West?
So it is a little bit, not just anybody. You know, back in the day on Prime, anybody could upload movies, and you'd get all sorts of illegal versions on Prime.
Wow.
Amazon kind of closed that loop a little bit.
Someone needs to get me Rise, Roar, Repeat, if that's the
case. Tubi, I have a feeling it's more like a distributor, maybe a shady distributor uploads it, but then doesn't. You know. And this is the one thing I was saying.
A .biz distributor.
I kind of love Tubi. Tubi is the shady video store that's like not affiliated with Blockbuster.
It's the shady video store we have left.
Yeah, it's like they got the curtain with the weird guys going in the back. Like, that's Tubi. There's
things
a seediness.
In envelopes. They hand you things in envelopes, not boxes.
There is, and we love it. We all love it. Tubi, we will take sponsorships.
Oh, sure.
We say this on the Disaster Girls pod so much. Tubi, we're here for you. I know you're advertising in the fucking Major League Baseball playoffs now, but we are the roots.
I actually don't mind the breaks, too.
19.
Yeah, I was watching Tubi movies this week, and like the commercial breaks, I'm like, I'm kind of here for it. It's like, all right, I can go check my phone and it's not breaking up.
In our pre-pod conversation, we're like, oh, you mean they're inventing cable again with like, yes, streaming bundles and stuff like that? I love the Tubi commercials. I'm like, ooh, bathroom break. Like, oh, gotta run and get my snack. Like, I saw one of my favorite, like, nostalgia, the kids weren't there tweets I've ever seen, was somebody being like, man, you ever just miss that feeling of like the commercial sets in and you have to sprint through your house to do everything you need to do in like 90 seconds before you get back? Like, they don't know that kind of adrenaline rush anymore. And I was like, they really don't. And I do love that.
I do too.
It's so much more satisfying than pods, like sprinting back into your chair and throwing yourself into it in time.
I didn't even know there were Tubi commercials. Oh man, I'm missing out. Like gold. Shit. No.
You have like a premium Tubi hookup? Is that what's going on?
No, I don't. Well, unfortunately, I haven't used it yet. So, but I didn't even know there were commercials.
He just said he's too good for Tubi, is what he's basically saying.
He's going to the high class.
Look here,
store.
Mr. Tubi. If you're listening, please, will you take the monies for the Tubi promotions and you give me a month trial. I'll watch it or whatever.
It's free.
It's free.
It's all free.
Well, yeah. No, I'm saying, like, you know, just still, I want to have it. Just have it. It'd be like, I am 2B's chosen one to get the month's pile of free stuff. You know, it's free. That's what I want. I want the recognition of 2B Master. Meister. 2B Meister.
I want that validation.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Oh. The point I was trying to make.
Yes, sir.
Simply that you cannot judge a DTV action movie sitting on the shelf for 2 years the way you might a major Hollywood movie, because there are plenty of times that, you know, you get the money for the movie and then the money for distribution just evaporates. You know,
especially in a fucking pandemic. I mean,
You know, I pointed out that both Ninja and Undisputed 3 sat on the shelf. God, I think Undisputed 3 was on the shelf for almost 2 years before it finally got, and that's Undisputed 3. So like, it's not really a surprise. Now that doesn't mean that this is actually going to be a good movie, but I do think people should be excited to watch it. And
you know what sat on the shelf for multiple years? Underwater. And that movie kicks ass. So miss me with your like, oh no, it got caught in turnaround. You know what else is really good? All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. I think perhaps Amber Heard's best movie. And that sat on the shelf for 7 years. They made it in 2006. It came out in, I think, 2013. And I remember being like, oh man, I started pressing play. And I was like, oh, I can't wait to like watch this train wreck because I love a bad slasher. And I was like, oh, this is really good. Like, we just weren't watching movies. We weren't doing slashers like this in the 2000s. It's a bit more pared down than like the sort of like Michael Bayization of the slasher wave at that time. And then like watching that, it was just like, oh, this hangs to me with the best of what came out of that decade. And again, like 2006 to 2013. So give me a dusted off treasure.
Yeah. The other one that I always talk about with that is Broken Path. Still on the shelf. Still on the fucking shelf. One of the greatest fight movies ever made. Still on the shelf. So yeah. Liam, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say that all the Boys Love Mandy Lane. I'm friendly with the producer, Keith Calder. And I think that was all just a shady deal with the distributor, and they just were blocking it. It had nothing to do with the quality. It was it was all about the legal and the money and people being assholes.
Yeah, and as Mike just said, sometimes that distributor situation just goes bug fuck. Mm-hmm. So yeah, show up, people.
Okay, what was the next trailer for us, Mike?
Next trailer is one I am super excited about. It is director Mabrouk. I'm going to butcher his name, I'm sure. Mabrouk El Metri's new movie. For those who don't know, he directed the great JCVD.
Great JCVD.
Arguably Van Damme's best performance. Mm-hmm. Certainly one of his best, and certainly one of his best movies. It's called Kung Fu Zora. Liam, let's start with you. What did you think of this trailer?
It was great. I could not find an English subtitled version, so I'm not 100% sure on exactly what the story is. But you know, that the shot of the older gentleman flying through the air and delivering that double kick to the side of the guy's head, and then you know, getting the spirit of like the domestic quarrels through kung fu fighting. I definitely thought it looked great, and excited to see the movie. And yeah, I'm a big fan of JCVD. I always think of that end scene the scene where he's in the back of the cab just getting yelled at by that woman, and it's pretty much just like a penance for his entire life. And that was definitely one that stuck with me.
Jordan, how about you?
It was really exciting to watch. I hadn't watched it until you guys were like, okay, we're gonna talk about this one. And it was like, again, another really savvily cut trailer that introduced, like, to break it up in the middle with that guy's feet coming in from out of frame being like, oh, this is the kind of movie that it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And to watch, like, multiple times in the trailer, you watch this woman get slapped in the face, whether by like the father of her child, or it seems like this man in a hallway who she's just not like going to put up with it anymore. And to watch, it's just like, you get that twinge of just like, and like, you got this kicky music and you know that the movie's going to be like taking a sort of fun spin on whatever's going on. And then you're like, oh, there's also like abuse here and domestic violence. And then you watch her going to training. And when she I couldn't find an English subtitle one either, but she seems to hand her man divorce papers. And she's like, that's it, we're getting divorced. Because she's been training and she knows exactly what's going to happen when he gets those papers. He's going to try and whip her ass, but she's fucking ready when it happens. So I am really looking forward to what unfolds in this one. This looks like a lot of fun.
Nice.
This is not a hot take per se, but you know how we were talking about a few weeks ago, the new Daniels movie with the Michelle Yeoh, Everywhere, whatever. You know, like, you know, oh, it's A24 is the one, you know, with that movie. And like, you know, everybody was freaking out. They were like, oh my God, this is the best trailer in the universe of this year or whatever. And I'm like, I mean, sure, I guess, you know. like the vibe I got from this trailer, from Kung Fu Zora, is that's what I'm feeling that people are saying from that Daniels movie. Like, there's this energy, this spark to it, where it's like, but there's like real pathos to it. Again, even though I don't fully pick up exactly what's happening, lack of the subtitles or like translation, but just the imagery and the emotion that's conveying it, it's a really powerful thing. Plus, you know, it's like that. It has that tone of the being goofy as fuck, but also like being serious. Like,
yeah,
with the tone, the subject matter that we're talking about. So yeah, like, again, I'm not trying to like fight nobody or put down the director who's doing a thing coming up, but it's like when people talk about supporting different quote unquote movies or you know, the ingenuity and the spirit of independent cinema. It's like this shit right here. You know, it's not like some fucking, you know, Sundance, Love Boys that, you know, got all this clout now. It's like, this is where you got to put the energy to supporting the stuff that might otherwise not see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, that's what I got from this trailer. Just that fun verve of like, you know, I haven't seen anything quite like this before. You know, but again, you know, it's like, it's low key, but it's like, there's so much, you can see that the creativity and ingenuity in it. And so I'm really excited about all of that front. And so I hope that, you know, when it comes out, I hope it does well. Or hope it is, you know, I hope it does live up to expectations, because that I think things like that are worth championing far more than, you know, whatever like fucking movie that's gonna be made by some indie director and then next year's make a Marvel movie that everybody's gonna hate. That's how they say.
I'm so grateful that that's a thing that you repeatedly come back to, Vice and Champion, is just this idea of like, listen, you guys want to talk about saving fucking movies. There's plenty of movies. There's plenty of cinema you can save by just looking a little deeper, like letting the algorithm sort of lead you through the channels. And there are many tiers of independent cinema. And certainly I want to boost something that is going to get like the little movie that could, that's going to end up at Sundance, that's going to get the audience award and be a sort of insurgent film. But a movie that ends up just by default with the cosign of a festival stamp like that. Like if you're a little movie that could, and you got into Fantastic Fest, well, then you already have the Fantastic Fest seal of approval. That's going to at least conversationally allow you to reach a threshold of audience that a movie like Invincible, that a movie like this isn't inherently going to get. So I so appreciate that you keep going back to like, everybody wants to talk about how nobody's got original ideas. It's all remakes. You hate IP. Like, okay. But as somebody, like, I feel like as people on this podcast who are always watching things that are not based on someone's previous idea, that didn't have the money to like adapt from a hit book, there's so much creativity exploding out there all of the time, working in the utmost of constraint, under the utmost of constraints, that we can wonder at and that we can champion. So I so appreciate you going back to that.
Yeah, repeatedly. Like we just said, like Invincible is just Universal Soldier, but fuck it, that's fine. It's like you know, whatever. Bring, like, do your own take on it. That's fine. That's okay. Like nobody's mad at, you know, remakes per se. It's just like, I don't know. It's just a weird, like, I don't know if it's double standard is a word, but people say they want different stuff. And then watch the same old boring ass, you know, Sundance Cracker movies. And it's like, you say that, but you don't mean it, you know, whatever.
Agree.
Sorry to all the Sundance. I apologize to all the Sundance Crackers. I didn't mean it. No offense.
You realize where I live, right? I am literally, right? Like, I live in Salt Lake City.
That's true. I'm going to come to Sunday. I've never been. I would love to go, and then I'll just crash on your couch.
Yeah. Well,
I saw your Laserdisc collection this weekend. I'm going to just dig through all of the Michael Scott.
This is a funny story. I used to have, in an old apartment, I had all my movies, DVDs, Laserdiscs up, and I had so many people that would come in and just like, be like, hey, I'm just going to borrow this. That I actually printed out a sign and posted it on my bookcase and said, I'm not fucking Blockbuster. It's right down the street.
It's really rude and presumptuous. What is that?
It's People do it. The last thing I do want to say about Kung Fu Zora is action for everyone. Fans should also perk up at this movie because the fight choreographer and action directors are Mark David and Keffi Abrek, who did Veronica Knows Fury, which is one of the all-time great ass-kicking movies from the last like 5 years. So the fight scenes and the stunts in this, as the trailer shows, are they're going to be good. They're going to be top level stuff. So I think everybody should be really excited for this one.
Yes.
All right. So we got a new Michael Jai White movie this week that all four of us watched. And and we're going to, you know, I think we're going to kind of start, you know, and part of this was, you know, when we talked about Jordan having you come on, was part of that was to talk about Michael Jai White and how he is to action cinema. So I'm going to kind of start with you before we get specifically into The Commando, because I don't know that there's a ton we want to say about the movie itself.
But right.
When did Michael Jai White, you know, when did he become a big action star for you that you started paying attention to?
It was Spawn. I had the movie poster in my room. He was my first favorite superhero. It's crazy to think about that movie now. Movie is so fucking dark and grotesque. Like the performance that John Leguizamo is giving in that movie as the, I can't remember his name, but that demon clown. And yeah,
it's clown.
And it just like, it's so like, and his whole character is so sexually infused and so just like sick and fucked up. And that like the 90s, in my estimation, the 90s are the weirdest decade of cinema we've ever had. It was this threshold, like we had mastered practical effects and like the technology was there as such to make practical sort of better than it had ever been, right on the threshold of like digital encroachment. So we hadn't started putting the digital paintbrush on things really because a little too dicey, which is why those horrible fucking the mind of the vision of the creator George Lucas retouches to the original Star Wars trilogy are an abomination. We weren't ready to like just go back and digitally be stitching shit into a Star Wars movie yet. So like it was this threshold of you have the booming indie cinema movement. You have it seems like a movement in Black cinema that now we are trying to get back to what was possible in the 90s for Black cinema. You have new queer cinema where it feels like we are also now trying to get to sort of with queer innovation and storytelling and representation, what we were like exploring in the 90s through Todd Haynes movies and Greg Araki movies. And you had Sundance sort of at its like most Wild West zenith, where you were and you had like, you know, the most popular indie, you know, the most bankable indie movie of all time in Pulp Fiction. Like there was so much rawness and craziness and sort of anything is possible 90s, anything is possibleness in the 90s that like you just kind of can't recapture that madness. I mean, there's a fucking Pierre Junet alien movie coming out of the 90s. Like, are you kidding me? And then so like when we're like, you know what? Superhero movies seem like a good idea. Like we've had Christopher Reeve as Batman in the past and we love Michael Keaton as Batman with that whole Tim Burton thing. Who about fucking Spawn, you guys? Like, let's make a deep horror action movie in Spawn. And there you have Michael Jai White just carrying this movie on his very broad and capable shoulders. And that was my introduction to him. And I just like, Michael Jai White's one of those kind of guys where I will just put Michael Jai White in the search engine on Netflix and be like, what's available from the guy now? And I'll just watch literally anything because he's in it. So he's one of those guys that I just know I can find and I'm going to enjoy him on screen no matter what else is happening, which is a bit how I feel about The Commando. My number one knock against the movie is that like, he's only in like half of it. I wish it was a Michael Jai White movie with more Michael Jai White. And then, you know, accompanying that comes the you know, what would come with the sadness of not seeing Michael Jai White on screen in a movie in a MJW DTV level action movie. Yeah.
Liam,
I'll definitely second that. It does feel like he had a quick shooting schedule on this movie. But to go back to the what a whole journey of an answer, it was kind of interesting because Spawn's definitely where I was introduced to him, and I also remember he did like a lot of talk shows like he was out promoting it, and he would like pull out ninja swords, and like he was doing like martial art demos on late night. And if you would Google it, and I was like, who is this guy? Because he was fucking huge and pretty ripped back then too.
Yeah.
But it is kind of crazy to think Spawn came out a year before Blade. Because it does feel like, you know, what was his first? Was he in Universal Soldier: The Return? That was his first one.
After Spawn, though.
But that was after Spawn. So he kind of came from nowhere into this leading role on like a pretty big budget studio film. It's crazy.
He did an HBO.
Tyson.
That was pretty much his first big starring role, and
which he's excellent in. Like it's a well done film. He's really good in it.
Yeah, and so from there, then he's the, because that's where I first saw him, and that's when he springboarded into Spawn.
Got it.
The thing I really appreciate him about as an entity is that he identifies himself as a martial artist. He seems to identify himself consistently as a martial artist first and foremost. And, you know, and he, you know, he identifies as an artist and as a creative, as an actor, but as a martial artist first and foremost. And I like that throughout all these years in his long career, he's acted, he's directed, he's produced, he's kind of done it all throughout his oeuvre. I feel like there can be a sort of, in the way that horror gets kind of, there was that, you know, it's elevated horror period of time where people were sort of scrambling to be like, well, it's really more of a drama with horror elements, and to like put the thing that your movie is in drag to sound like it's something that it is somehow more appealing in a different costume to other people, or I don't know, to make yourself feel better about what you've made, because there's a stigma around horror film, to present yourself as first and foremost, I'm a martial artist. That's like, that to not be like, well, I'm a real thespian and I consider like martial artists my primary tool of communication. It's like, no, he gives the respect to the medium and to the skill and to the expertise that he has first and foremost. And I really appreciate that after all this time, he doesn't try and sell it as something other than it is to maximize another aspect of his career and his profession and minimize the thing that has sort of fueled and that he's really built his life around, his whole sort of like personality and value structure around. I really respect that about him.
And you just spoke with him on the podcast, right? On your podcast.
Yeah. And he was like, through various publicist waves and such, the premise didn't really get to him until the moment we were sitting in front of him, and his ability to just like his willingness to be game on the spot, to be like, oh yeah, I got a couple movies for sure I can talk about like that. And just to adapt and to engage in this conversation with me in a substantial way. I was so pleased. I was so happy about it. And I so appreciated his willingness to be like, yeah, let's switch it up. Like I've been doing press all day. Like I've had, I don't know how many interviews, but of course, like I'll meet you where you are and not be resistant to it or not like be caught off guard. I really appreciated that about him as a guest in a conversational format.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I knew him from these, the martial arts films as well. But, and even though he identifies, you know, as that from martial arts first, like, he's in, like, these really successful, like, Tyler Perry movies and shows, too. Like, it's almost like there's, like, a, I don't know how to describe this. There's, like, a whole, he has whole separate fan bases. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I doubt you guys have seen a Tyler Perry movie or TV show or, you know, because, but he's been, like, he was in several seasons of this, a really popular TV show, for better or worse. Like, it's a spinoff of his appearances in the Tyler Perry films, or this long series of films, like the Mad World Drama. So, like, but he like, which is to say, he is also a legit thespian. Like, it's like he's like a show business person as well, along with all the you know, the multiple black belts. Like, but you know, and I like that he said that he's humble, or like he doesn't try to put on airs about either one. You know, depending on the context of what the job is, he can do it all. So I guess the main thing I'll say about the movie The Commando is that I don't recommend it overall. You know, if you're like one of the action fans, you know, that we're like, you know, how's this? You know, it's very, very rough overall. It's just a difficult, you know, things with budget or strip, you know, that's kind of, we expect that stuff as DTV fans, you know, but unfortunately, just to really come together as well. You know, it's more of a like a siege thriller, like house thriller, than an actual action movie.
Yeah,
this issue is that like those two parts don't really cohere together properly.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been, I could see this script being like an actual, teen slasher horror thing, just easily it could be a PTSD soldier revenge killer kind of thing. But of course, these didn't really come together. But that's just the nature of the beast. When we watch these things, ideas don't always work. But at least that everybody's game to it. Everybody's committed. Because it also has Mickey Rourke. The great, memorable. Yeah. The legendary and also somewhat tragic figure. I think we might say. We've been talking about this several times over the past few weeks about how these high level or A-list actors are, people always say, oh, why are they doing this like bargain bin TV stuff? As we've kind of discussed, they love the job. The acting is the job for them. Mm-hmm. It's passion. I don't want to say that, these guys are just slowing it. That will never be the case for me. I think, even though I don't think most of the movie works overall, I'm seeing, Michael Jai White is committing to this portrayal of PTSD, using the part where he's using these therapist techniques of how to, mm-hmm, ground yourself in space, and he's doing the actual motions, doing the actual thing. Then you see Mickey Rourke's character. He's like a former army veteran who has turned to life of crime, which, as I've talked about before, the whole modern veterans turn to armed robbery kind of thing. There's a whole backstory to him in that. That he's working, that he's using it as to work off of, to build off in his lines here. So even though, like I said, even though it doesn't really come together all the well, there's all that depth they're trying to convey to you in this small, simple film. And I really appreciate that effort, even if it doesn't always work. The effort is always there. The spirit is always there. So I'll never disparage that, because a lot of these big budget movies don't got that shit, we all know that.
Well, yeah, he talked about that specifically as because he clearly, Michael Jai White makes a lot of movies. He commits to a lot of things. And he said that the reason why he said yes to this one was specifically because of how, of this guy's willingness and his ability to engage with therapeutic tactics to cope with what he had gone through. And that really appealed to him. And he was glad to see that in the story. And he didn't feel like he saw it often enough. So that was why he was this one stands out to me as things that I'm offering, things that I'll take my time out for. So I think it's a very good point, Vice.
Well, and it's actually almost one of the biggest problems with the movie for me. And I thought the movie was perfectly okay. I mean, I tweeted out, it was perfectly okay. I thought, but the biggest problem for me was I was much more interested in the Michael Jai White PTSD recovery drama than I was in a lot of the action stuff, because he's really doing some terrific stuff. The one thing I will give this movie credit for, when I put it on, because I hadn't even watched the trailer, I rented it, I put it on, I did not expect the opening of this movie to go,
oh my God,
as it went. I did not see that coming. So I will tip my hat to the movie for that. It's not really a spoiler because it's, what sets up the whole plot, but basically Michael Jai White inadvertently kills a bunch of people
seemingly and when we say people, it seems like he accidentally kills a bunch of human trafficking victims that he is probably ostensibly there to save, and that'll haunt you.
Yeah, that'll fuck you.
Fuck.
Note to self: do not fire rounds into drywall whenever you're storming into a building. I'm biting my tongue, but there's one trope that I just really don't like, and it's just something that I just wish people would do less: is the instant flashback. We just saw them dead, and it goes to credits. Within the next scene, we are flashing back to the scene that we just saw.
Do you watch any of the Saw movies, Liam? Do you watch any of the Saw movies?
I tapped out at 3. I have not.
I'm not going to be like, gone. Everybody, listen up. Here's my case. The only reason I bring that up is because one of my favorite, and it's so Saw, one of my favorite things about the Saw franchise is that the end of every movie includes a previously in this movie for 90 seconds of montaging the entire movie just to be right before the final twist or reveal or thing happens, it just gives you like a like last week on Mad Men moment where you run through the whole fucking movie. And it's like Saw is best binged, in my opinion, as a whole entire experience, because basically you watch it, it's like, oh, this is a sci-fi series from 1998. Like as that kind of packaging, the Saw movies are high class. But that is, it is a total Saw movie ending to make that choice. And that's not necessarily an endorsement of that choice, but it is okay. Fucking hilarious.
Yes. They're like looking at the runtime and they're like 79 minutes and 35 seconds. Okay. 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 We hit 80. That's it. Done.
Well, I think what, like in the way that you were talking, Vice, about it, like the not coming togetherness, I think for me, really the split is like, if this movie wasn't an MJW movie, I'd be this movie God. Makes total sense as what it is. Like if this was a home invasion where the girls are fighting off Mickey Rourke, honestly, give me that movie. But it was like, I would have calibrated my like incoming, like what, you know, my start value for the movie differently. But because like you see him in it, you're like, oh, it's one of his movies. It doesn't feel like a Michael Jai White movie because it really only partly is. It feels like a more direct TV brand movie without one of those like real industry workhorse stars where you kind of know that like, no matter what, you're getting this guy and that's cool. It feels like a movie he was stitched into that like correspondently the execution of it feels more like the other parts of the movie than it does him.
Yeah, it feels right. Like starred Sean Ferris or somebody like that.
Oh my God. Give me that and give me so much homoeroticism. Please. Shots fired. Hey, no one does homoeroticism in like B-tier action like Sean Ferris. That guy.
Nobody loves Sean Ferris more than I do. That dude was in a rugby movie about my high school rugby team.
Man. Never back down.
Oh man.
My dear beloved Sam Wyman, who I co-host the Odds Pod with, he was like, he's not a sports movie guy. He's not necessarily an action movie guy, but he's like, did you see Never Back Down in theaters 3 times? Boy, I sure did. did you see Penn Badgley and Sean Ferris and that? It's like, absolutely. That is one of those, I love the category of action movie that is as much for young gay men finding themselves as it is for me or anybody on this podcast. That is such a special genre of action film.
The Penn Badgley, he's the bad guy, right? The bad kid.
Yeah, movie? He's the bad guy the mean goatee.
Yeah, so he has like the eight pack striated abs, whereas Sean Ferris has like the standard 4-pack homegrown All American boy abs.
Yeah, homegrown All American boy could have just got off the football field.
I haven't talked to somebody, but I should have talked about Mike before. But like, that's such a perfect like, is it like a. The story and casting, story and action, story and visuals, but like
story and abdominals.
Yeah, like here is the all-American good boy with the regular abs, and here's this like the coked out, millennial rich boy.
You know what totally reinforces that vice is Cam Gigande's whole 2000s. Cam Gigande was the coked out 8-pack guy against literally Sean Ferris's like more accessible abs guy. You're right. This is in the way that I've recently talked a little bit about, like, if there is a scene where a girl applies lipstick and makes a whole fucking meal out of it, that girl's going to be a bitch at some point in the movie or the show. That's going to be a character trait. She's going to kill people. She's going to try and ruin someone's life. If you're the guy with the 8-pack abs versus the guy with like the abs you could get from just doing normal sports, then you're going to be a fucking dickhead at some point.
You're going to be a fucking, date rapist or whatever. It's like, that's the law in the movies. Oh, perfect. They're back there. Oh, wait. And this brings us full circle because, you know, part of what's whole Michael Jai White's whole deal is like he's like the one of the DTV like resurgent kings. He brought that film franchise into DTV and kept it going for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think we spoke briefly of the newest one. It didn't start him. It starts with Michael Bisping taking on part of the star. But and this is what I also want to say. Like, I also appreciate that Michael Jai White, it's not just about he's doing the movies too, but I've also seen a lot recently in the past few years. He's doing teaching, like not just as a dojo instructor, but like using the medium, YouTube, social media, the movies themselves as teaching tools for other up and coming artists. Like, so yesterday, actually. So I was just on YouTube and the algorithm brought to me this, there's a guy here. So he's a, young independent short filmmaker. The YouTube channel is called Water Tribe Productions. It's a guy and a few kids, they just do like action shorts, just kind of, doing it like a lot of people do on YouTube. And then all of a sudden I see, he has a few videos about himself and his crew doing action shorts. But then all of a sudden he has Michael Jai White with him in the gym in like in LA Fitness in the room, and Michael Jai White is teaching this young YouTuber the ins and outs of screen action. Like this, like he just appeared randomly on this kid's channel and it's showing him like it's showing him the ropes. Like I'm like, this is amazing. Like this is an actual, you know, the Sifu, the sensei. Like, he's doing that not just as a martial artist, but he's unifying those parts of himself as the actor, as the entrepreneur, as the industry businessman, and you know, and the, you know, into this, he's showing kids how it's done. And that's like, I think maybe that now in this age of his, this stage of his career, that's maybe the most admirable thing, is that he knows these are like the later years of his life. He's passing this down to the generation of film fans, fight fans, and fighters on screen. That was like I was really just really taken back by that. It's like this kid's like, you know, like he has like, you know, maybe 100 views per video. Now this one has 17,000. It's crazy.
I think the whole man aspect of his sort of life and career balance, and he was very emphatic about balance when I was talking to him, sort of in all things of his life. I think it really seemed to come through that is extremely important to him as a priority. So that makes sense. And I think he's kind of a good dude.
Yeah, thankfully we need more of those in the industry, in the world in general. Yeah.
And he wants more than anything to make more comedies that are action. And I think this very funny writer director that happens to be a co-host of this podcast would be a great marriage for Michael Jai White.
Because I need someone like you guys that are actually funny to write it. I'll direct it though, for sure.
I really feel like you do have a good way with humor. I feel like you really like, I feel like there's a wry sensibility about you where like, it's not about jokes. You just like, you're with the Wonderliner. You're good on your feet. Like I think it comes
this
through.
Is,
in the,
this
in
is
the
why
character.
She's invited back over and over again. Yeah.
I mean, Rhona Mitra is going to bring everything Rhona Mitra brings to a role, but she had a character to work with in Skylines 3. And like having read some of your work, like stuff you're working on for future stuff, like I feel like there's a very sort of, you know, not that I don't love a tryhard, Misty Yellow Jackets, we love you. Like tryhards are great. I try hard, but like there is a really easy sense of like real person sort of comedy and wit. I feel like that comes through in your characters where it doesn't like, and now we got to add like some jokes and some lulls into here. It's just like, no, this is just how, you know, this is just how some dudes rock relating to each other shit would happen in a character context like this. I feel like you're really good at stuff like that.
Well, it's Jordan has read the Skyline 4 draft, so that's what she's really talking about, which is fantastic.
I was
Thank
so
you.
Fucking ready to watch that movie when I read that. It was like, it was like on fire.
Well, I do think that's a credit of like actually writing a movie that's already fully cast and you just being like, oh, I could. Because I know all the characters.
It's almost like writing. It's almost like being in like your second season writing for TV at that point. Yeah. It's like, oh my God, I know these people. Like,
yeah,
I
never had that experience before. And it was a lot of fun. But no, thank you so much. And I would definitely love to work with Michael Jai White. It is kind of crazy that we've talked to him for this long and we haven't brought up Black Dynamite. You know, but.
We haven't brought up Blood and Bone either. I mean, his pinnacles, right? The peak of what he does.
I will say like there was something that I wanted to attach to the conversation around Commando, which is something I've been thinking a lot about lately. And, you know, say this isn't the Michael Jai White movie and it's the sort of other version of it where he really is just a guy who's a dad and a husband on a road trip with his wife and some fucked up shit starts happening back home. Like, and it's like this home invasion, say with the exact same rest of the cast. There is a whole category, you know, there, Hollywood is such a tricky place because that you think of like the aspirations of being like superstar, really famous, like A-list or one of those like a Cherry Jones or a, you know, Margot Martindale, not that Anne Dowden Margot Martindale like being referred to as character actors. They don't, they have said that, but like that brand of person who's like, every time they show up, it's like, well, that's going to be an Emmy for best guest appearance kind of thing. Like they could be the best supporting actor in anything they're in, even if it's 5 minutes, but you know what? A lot of people are fine. A lot of people are just okay. A lot of people who want to act are like decent. Fuck yeah. Give me decent actors and put them in this, put them in Commando and at all, like the adjacent kinds of movies, give them fucking 10 movies a year. I want just fine actors to have just fine shit to keep them paid and booked and busy. I support the right and the entitlement of the "you're okay" actor to have as many fucking movies and options as they want. I would love to have like a portion of my career as an eventual very important producer being like, you know what? I make 15 decent action movies a year and I love them. They're my treasures. And there, I this want is all, people this is to all, be in them.
We just want to work. Yeah. That's
like work. Like I do, like, you know, you meet like, and there's just so much of the dream there and there's so much of the striving and, you know, the way, you know, when I'm very careful when I meet people who are actors out at like a function or an event or something, if I learn they're an actor, and I feel like the worst thing to ask an actor is, oh, what have you been in? Because that means you haven't seen anything they've been in,
yes.
Which is you're trying to be nice and you're trying to inquire, but the implication of the question is fuck. So I always say, I'm like, what kind of stuff would you love to be in? Like, what's your favorite kind of thing to do? What would be like the ideal situation? And like that category of person who I encounter, who like, I want to ask the question in that way, so I don't feel like I put them down by being like, oh, I'm unfamiliar with your work kind of thing. It's like, because the point of an actor is visibility and the point of an actor is people know what you do. You know what? I want the people who I haven't seen half their movies, but they've made 97 of them in 6 years and they're having a great time. I want that class of actor to thrive. So I support the just okay movie and the people that can be in them. I have friends I know that I would love for them to be in as many just okay movies as they can a year, because to be out there and living and working and doing the thing that they came to this town to do. So I love and respect the just fine movie for that. And I wish it had more respect for that exact reason.
You know, it's funny. We're like talking about earlier what you were saying about like us, the whole society going back to older things and being like, hey, this wasn't so bad. And we're kind of saying like, maybe the studio system would be okay. Like everyone yeah. just like works and they're like, they're making right? movies all the time.
Like we don't, maybe like, with union protections, being yes. a contract player would well, actually be kind of cool.
The like, problem with the DTV world right now is because it's actually the problem with the big budget world as well. And it's why when I get so frustrated when I watch, you know, even big budget movies, is that everything is so compressed about the actor's time. And mm-hmm. it's all just oh. all about getting them in and out of this movie as fast as possible, because mm-hmm. the more movies that they can make a year, even, you know, these top guys, and the faster they're in and out,
totally.
You know, it's all about like, I want to get paid the most amount of money for the smallest amount of work.
That feels like Bruce Willis's entire current iteration.
I know, but you could say, I mean, like that's also what Red Notice looked like, you know what I
yeah.
mean? Like,
oh, totally.
So that's like a $200 million movie with these big stars that are like in their prime focused, whew. And it still feels like they're getting boarded out. So mm-hmm. There is this like, I don't know. There's some type of alternative model to mm-hmm. actually like figuring this out, because it feels like the pressure of that ugh. Is making movies very unbalanced. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those reasons why I keep saying how much I love No Time to Die, because it actually looked like they spent money on shooting days.
Wow.
It did not look like they spent money on like, you know, stitching things together in post, you know. It was like, mm-hmm. no, they're the $200 million of money that this movie spent did it the right way. It's not all on, you know, all these other things. It's actually on the stunts. It's actually on the things that are on camera. It's the location. So that's kind of more than the content of the movie.
Yeah.
It's the approach of that movie that I am like, that I laud so heavily, because it actually looks like a big world-class production. And so many of these big budget movies just frankly don't.
I think that hits on the head exactly how I've been trying to sum up my feelings about, not to take us on too long a tangent, but like about No Time to Die, which is, I felt such a, like, I was so surprised by the amount of wonder I felt watching that movie. I think that's exactly it. Like, I felt like I could see those $200 million on screen in camera in such a tangible way. It wasn't like, in the way that like, yeah, I can see that The Eternals was also really expensive too, but I was watching that being like, man, fucking movies, right? Like that movie was like the case for $200 million in some ways. And I really, really appreciated that.
We don't have to have Mike react to this. We'll move on to the next thing. Speaking of which, a big budget movie that
I
you
also
say
really
one
like
thing?
Six Underground, Mike. Yes.
No. Okay. I'm not going to say anything about, I have a perfect heel statement for.
Okay, good.
I was going to say, yeah, you're right. They spent $200 million on locations and shooting days and things like that, and none of it on the script. But
listen, if you want to just give all that money to Anna de Armas, I would have been fine with it. But it, like, it decided to do more
before.
But I hear you.
Too far on. The one thing I do want to correct, because otherwise people will DM me, because for some reason they DM me when we get back down, is the Sean Ferris High School MMA movie, Forever Strong.
Forever Strong. My error. Oh, forgive me. You're so right. It's Forever Strong.
And I'm not kidding. It's based on my actual, I didn't play rugby, but
that's right. It's in Utah.
Yeah, it's Highland High School. It's where I went to school. So anyway, all right, now.
Okay. I just do a quick segue from, you know, expensive movies that don't quite look expensive. I'm going to try to navigate my discussion on Snake Eyes, which I watched this weekend, which also had unfortunate timing that I had watched Ninja 2, the Atkins Florentine absolute classic, like five-star banger.
Yeah.
Having kind of caught up with a lot of Scott movies this past year, I think Ninja 2 might be the most me of all of his movies. Like, I really fucking just love how much action they put in this, how much variety of action, and how pulp the adventure is. Like, it actually looks like there's scenes of this that look like it could be the cover of like a 1950s like Man's Life, like him like cutting the head off a snake in the jungle. Like, it's just so incredible, and it also is like there's a little bit of a thing I was thinking about with the violence in Ninja 2 that I feel a kinship towards. And we were talking about this on like our preferences pod, guys, when we were saying like, what type of movie do you like? It's like, even there's a lot of violence in it, but it never lingers on it. Like, even when someone's getting their neck done, like, you don't see tissue and like ripped out throats. It's like, it's all kind of like a goes down easy 80s, 90s McTiernan sort of our level to me, that I find very, very watchable. But of course, he's also, you know, smoking crack and kicking the shit out of people. I know one of the discussions that Mike and I had is that it is jarring that, you know, they kill his wife, his pregnant wife, who is you know, a main character in the first movie, right onto the second. But I was wondering if there, you know, there's all these different reasons why that could have happened. It could have been scheduling, like it could have been they had a tougher time on the first one than we know. You just never know. But that was definitely like a dark opening to the movie. But I did feel like it earned it by the end of how crazy his vengeance trip was, and just so thoroughly entertaining of a movie, so well shot, constructed. It is just an absolute crime against cinema that Isaac has not been given bigger and better opportunities. So to contrast that to, you're going to make a Snake Eyes movie that is an origin story and is going to be, martial arts and gritty underworld thing. And to just go with this director who is like from a completely different world and skill set, I did not. So when people say something is badly directed, what do they mean? Because what does that actually mean? What is the job? Well, there's things that they obviously did well, and I don't know whose decisions would have made, but the cast is great. I love the casting. I think almost every single role is stacked with great actors that I'm excited to see. Now, the thing that bothers me about it is a lot of it is just straight up in the actual placement of the camera within the thing. And it's not so much about the action scenes. I think the camera position is almost generally 3 inches too low in almost every single shot in the movie. And so you don't have Henry Golden, who is one of the most handsome people in the world. He's not looking as sexy as he should. They're doing a lot of wide angle close-ups, which distort the human face. Andrew Koji has a very thin face, and so he can actually hold up in these wide angle close-ups that they're putting on him all the time. But if you have like any type of a normal face, it kind of fucks your face up when you do, you can do these tests on actors yourself. There's a reason why some of the most beautiful shots that we think of are long lens, you know, and that kind of, it defocuses the background and you can really focus on a face. But so that is right from the first fight, right from the first shot of Henry Golding. It's like, it's all these wide angle close-ups. The camera's really low. It's low, 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 always looking up. And I just don't think it's putting him in this best position to, you know, be this charismatic movie star. And it's like he's fighting it the entire movie. And it, you think of the, something being off, and it is sometimes just that. It's like their entire approach to the way the visuals were in this movie. To me, it is not so much about the action as it was the actual visual approach to it. And I also didn't like this piss colored fucking coloring scheme. Everything in the whole movie like reeks of piss. And
bring it back to 2000s.
Yeah, it's just like it's all this yellow tinted looking through urine thing. And it's like this is supposed to be fucking sexy. We've seen Andrew Koji on Warrior look sexy. We've seen Henry Golding look sexy. We've seen Ikura Wise look sexy. Mm. And these guys are not they're not doing him any favors, which, by the way, it was great to see Iko. The camera loves him. I just still feel like he's a movie star. He needs to be the lead of movies, and that's bothering me as well. So anyway, did not like that movie. found very frustrating. And the potential was so high. And I don't know what else I could say to be on the bright side of that other than, man, felt like a real missed opportunity.
Fun fact, yeah. I was working at a cafe one time out on a patio here in LA, and I just looked to my left and there was the second son, Henry Golding, radiating light and beauty a couple of feet away from me with his beautiful wife. And I was just like, the idea that Henry Golding would have to be competing with something for what comes off of him to be perceived through, it's like, what a crime. The man was like a living fucking Ralph Lauren polo ad next to me. It was startling. And to the idea of that being like, you had it in your hands. Like, come on.
I always tell that story about speaking of being the Sundance cracker.
that's a perfect category.
Paul Walker at Sundance. Same thing. Like, dude, just like literally from a block away.
Right.
He just glowed. Like, he just radiated. Vice, you were going to tag on to something Liam said.
Oh, I was going to say he is excommunicado now in a few seconds. You know, snake eyes. But I spoke about this before several times. Like you all said, like the choreography is there. Just that, you know, the way it's framed so poorly. I think that, you know, this is kind of, it defeats itself. Kind of reminds me of what's the one that RZA did? Man with the Iron Fists. Which is, you know, which is like a strange kind of very strange experimental kind of movie, anyways. But you know, like the heart was there. Like I could see the choreography that he was doing was really legit, but like he just, I guess maybe because, you know, him being a director, being first time or not used to how they're supposed to work, I don't know, but it just was so, yeah, the team was framed too close, so it threw everything off. But I gave Snake Eyes a middling rating, but I feel like after, I don't know, I'm more lenient towards it now, I guess. I don't know. I can't explain it. Just knowing that the effort was there, it kind of puts it up for me from other stuff that I've seen. It's like you said, you can see all the money they throw on screen, but like it just kind of feels empty. Whereas this one, like you know, because it's trying to like, it's a Yakuza movie and a ninja movie.
It's a good script. I mean, yeah. I think I've met the writer of that movie. He's a fucking great writer. It's a good script. It's literally. It's the problem is the guy, like, you know, behind the monitor, man. I don't know what else to say. Everything else about it is good, except, you know, the person making the decisions. And it's one of the more frustrating movies I've seen in years.
If nothing else, you know, if it did well, at the box office. No, maybe it'll do well.
It did not do well at the box office. No.
Oh, did it?
No.
Massive. Oh, I thought it was.
It's a massive under. Performance.
Okay, so in that case, everything we're gonna see then, which is, you know, well, in that case, then hopefully all the crew, you know, Kinitanagaki and all the stuff, they'll find success elsewhere.
Oh, absolutely, they're at the top of their game, and I think anybody with two eyes can see that.
Here's the next turn. Like, so you think about, you know, this big budget movie with like that has good action, but it's captured terribly. If you guys listening in here on this post show, this weekend was the full streaming release of the brand new latest from Joel Cohen of the Coen Brothers. This is The Tragedy of Macbeth.
Ah, yes.
So on Apple Plus. Talk about being captured well. Holy shit, this fucking, it looks amazing.
Really quick, Vice, let me just pause you really quick because I actually had a perfect transition. And I was going to say, so let me at least get the transition out. I was going to say, we kind of want to wrap up by talking about remakes and who has been remade more in history than William Shakespeare.
You're not wrong. one of the original IPs.
The Michael Bay of the Dark Ages, sir. or the Renaissance, where the fuck it was. My history is fading. Well, yeah, you know, I'll tie it in though. Yeah. So first of all, look. So you got all these different renditions of Shakespeare and even Macbeth specifically, like in 2015, it was like a really hardcore Braveheart with sadness kind of one was starring what's the guy's name? The rapey guy, Fassbender. Yeah, it was like a really pretty well, high budget, prestige drama, which right. Nobody saw.
Yeah,
but, I heard it was great. I heard it was great. So now you have this. So now the new one here, starring one of the Coen brothers, famous, Fargo and all those, Velasquez, all the great movies there. It has this more like black and white, German.
It looks like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Like this movie looks like an early German expressionist horror film from the 1920s. It's it's gorgeous.
Yeah. And so people have said of the play itself, it's like the original horror film or the original or Shakespeare's works in general, like the original slasher film, Titus, a slasher movie really. Mm-hmm. Or action film or action revenge thriller, Hamlet, Mm-hmm. So that sense of propulsiveness or cinema, I guess, before we had the term for it, has always been part of his plays. And so you kind of see that people try to make that work on film in these various adaptations of his works. And so here it's really interesting to see that, it's using that more, it's all at once low key, but still striking because, being more minimalist, the power of it stands out more, I guess, mm-hmm, in this case. So, compared to the other, 1971 version or the 2015, it does the big actual scenes of battles and soldiers. It's just a couple guys, talking in the rooms. But, that's literally what it is. But also, these are also some of the best actors who have ever lived. Doing some of the best.
Yeah, you have your Macbeth and your Lady Macbeth is Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand.
Yeah. So this is what I'm saying. So talk about, Michael J. White, the stature of this big, strong action hero guy who can do it all. Yo, fucking Uncle Denzel. So Denzel, we've known him for a long time as he's a dramatic hero. He's a romantic hero. He's a, action kind of guy when he wants to be, he's a teacher. He's a scholar. He's a father. He's a lover. All that stuff. So now, as of course, as happens when age creeps up, some actors, they don't quite age gracefully.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We talked about Ricky Rourke, unfortunately, not to knock him, but it's a difficult, thing he's, dealing with. Some actors can move to that next level of, or next phase of themselves
mm-hmm.
more easily than others. Shit, Denzel, man, I think what encapsulated it was the Equalizer movies, because he's clearly an older man,
mm-hmm.
but that works because we know his iconography of being this badass, this emotional or this endearing badass.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taking care of these kids in the community with righteous violence, But now, and so we have all this to come to bear in Macbeth, this classic tragic play where this is tyrannous king this slubby dickhead who's grabbing power we see yet another element of Denzel, this avaricious man. But the thing about the movie is that, or the thing about the story is that Macbeth is kind of an invincible warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's part of the plot. He can't die, but here, in case you haven't seen Red Shakespeare, fucking classless goons, the
story. You unwashed masses that listen to our podcast.
Yeah.
So in the story,
Philistines.
In the story, the witches come to him saying he will be king, and that he cannot be. And later on, they tell him, cannot be defeated by anybody, a woman born. Fucking spoilers for a 415-year-old play, right? This is a fucking story. So in various adaptations, he's this mighty powerful warrior, mm-hmm. which is, you know, part of how he got to the level of Thane in the first place, and why he's so close to being a king in the first place, because he's a mighty warrior. So again, being very minimalistic, there's only like two actual fight scenes mm-hmm. in this new Tragedy of Macbeth. There's some of the best fight scenes of not just the last year, 2021, but in a long time. And again, it's just very, and they shot, again, because the cinematography is so superb, mm-hmm. you get to see Denzel, you get to see Uncle Denzel, old man Denzel, in his full final form glory. And he fights, in his story, it's a young Seward, it's a young English noble. He fights him unarmed, and he fucking wrecks him. Like, it's just a, you know, a quick minute scene, and it's like 2 minutes or thereabouts. But you see, just like, this is like a perfect, like a case study of cinema, like how to do action right. Like, mm-hmm. and you know, like if all you really need is a good / powerful centerpiece, the actor, some solid choreography, and a way to frame it properly. And, you know, mm-hmm. other things like, you know, the setting and anything help, you know, like this could have been in a fucking library. This could have been a bathroom. Yeah. Right. Been like, you know, yeah. what he's doing. What they're doing to each other is so powerful. But of course, it has this beautiful, like, not elaborate, but this stark throne room sequence. It's all coming together in this very minimal but very powerful thing. And it's like, so yeah, it's like, whether you have a budget or not, or whether you have this money or this talent or not, like, there's always this. Well, I mean, again, I haven't made a film, but like, so I can't. It's not like a step by step. This is what you need, but like, you can just see where things falter, where they succeed, by the examples that we have, you know, with the snake eyes or you know, like, or this shit, it's like, you know, this having Uncle Denzel wrecking dudes. It's like religious, you know?
It's light and shadow. Like the set is very, it's stylized in its way, but it's light and shadow. And it like, you know, when I remember when I came on and talked to Mike about the Expendables on his pod about just that, he talked about like action scenes as a ballet. Like, these are like the musical sequences of a musical film. And with what you have with Denzel is like, you have light, you have shadow, and you have somebody who will fill a scene of violence with so much pathos that like, as long as you get like the right choreography in there, and you imbue an incredible performance into the most sort of stark of material, something like this is possible, and it's really special to see.
Yeah, one of our followers, Andrew Crump, I think he said on Twitter, he was like, you know, Denzel doesn't really attack as much as he's like, he advances like a human glacier. This, like, he just like, oh. he's just walking forward just toward this guy with a sword, mm-hmm. and he's already, the battle is already won in his mind.
Because, right. Yeah.
That is his alphaness is his superpower. Cool. Like, that's always been. And, but yeah, it is sort of like, it's like a little bit like where we're always, you know, saying how let Scott, you know, do his fights. He's a human visual effect. But when you have these great actors, that it's kind of like Liam Neeson's whole second half of his career. It's like, when you have that great of an actor in an action movie and they're 100% committed, it is like a visual effect. It is like this extra spectacle just to see someone of that kind of a stature willing to be committed in an action scene like that. It kind of brings everything up a level. And I definitely would just, I didn't see the movie, but I, you know, Vice posted it on Twitter and I watched the clip. That double-handed push down is just like, if that happened to me in a fight, I would just turn and run away.
But like, also, it's like someone's vaguely like Baji Kwan style kung fu. Like, it's like that, these like power strikes that have this grounded in like from the base, you know, because if people don't know Denzel, he was an athlete, he was a basketball player. Back in Fordham, I'm shout out Fordham. Hey, like, you know, so he's an actual a natural athletic presence, but anyway, you know, he's like 6 feet tall, so he's an imposing man, whether he's like spawn at you or like about to fight you. So just having him, that he knowing how to use, uses all parts of himself so well.
Well, so, yeah. The basketball thing, the famous story on He Got Game was that he was supposed to like lose to Ray Allen. yeah, in the thing, but he just like went and hit every shot, and Raylan was like, "What the fuck is going on? And they were just filming it." Like, and he ended up like, yeah, it ended up becoming. She basically changed the script because he refused to miss the shots, and he was just like hitting everything.
He already knew the outcome. He already knew the outcome of that.
I'm Denzel fucking Washington.
So I would say, of course, you know, definitely recommend. If you're using this podcast as like a recommend buy or not buy meter, then yeah, I recommend going and watch Tragedy of Macbeth on Apple Plus. You do a 7-day free trial, you know, be cheap about it, so it's fine. Yeah. Nobody's gonna know, it's okay. So I want to roll in what Mike mentioned earlier, this whole thing about remakes and adaptations and stuff. Like, you know, here of course we have a perfect example of a beautiful firing all cylinders is the adaptation of older work, of older "quote unquote" IP. You know, it stings to call Shakespeare IP, but you know, but in our more modern context, you know, there's all these scripts and stuff have, you know, rights and there's money behind this stuff. So you know, this comes to bear with some recent news about how the very famous iconic action film The Raid has its remake going forward on Netflix, to be directed by Patrick Hughes. Now, most people may not be familiar with him, but he has some recent fairly modest hits, I think, such as the Hitman's Bodyguard in 2017, starring Ron Reynolds and Sam Jackson. And so, like, you know, of course, like with every big announcement of a remake of a, specifically of an Asian movie, there's always this like big uproar, this big outrage about, you know, why are they just making shit for Americans who don't want to read subtitles? And people need to understand, like, viewing remakes in general as a white people / North American problem is very disingenuous.
It's to ridiculous.
To how cinema works, how international cinema works. There's so many countries, so many film industries from the countries that remake other films all the fucking time. This is not a distinction of us being lazy Americans who don't want to read. Other people don't want to read either, or they want to see their stars, their talents, enact these stories that you know they're not like, and the stories themselves aren't necessarily like these for the most part, these distinct idiosyncratic things. Now, the movie can be successful because of that. You know, famously, for example, Old Boy, the Korean film, is a very difficult thing to translate all this cultural stuff. So, and then, you know, even the mighty Spike Lee couldn't do it properly. But, you know, there's various stories about why that did work out behind the scenes stuff.
Well, I mean, the whole, almost the entire Japanese horror import wave of the 2000s was not good. Like, The Ring was very good. Almost everything else that came over wasn't, because there is, particularly with the realm of the supernatural, there is just a non-transferable property about the relationship that Japanese culture and people have to myth and lore and death that you don't have here in the United States. So when you try to make it a one-to-one, you lose so much of like what makes that original film haunting, that it's just like, hey guys, you should have just like been inspired by and like credited and done your own thing. Like, story credit goes to like original writing. Cause like a remake of it is just like, we lose it in we literally lose it in translation, and it can't even be scary anymore. So,
As you said, like, you know, when it does work is when when you can somehow adjust or translate that the cultural depth. For example, the famous example is the Departed. She's Departed. Like, totally. it translates the Confucian kind of tragedy, the Confucian Baroque books and stuff from the Chinese version to the Catholic guilt kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In America, or in Boston specifically.
Homophobia in New England, yes.
It makes it its own cultural thing using that same basic template. So, and you know, but you know, in this case, The Raid, cops go into a building and shoot out people. Like, it's a fucking, it's like, it's made for to be remade. Like, it's such a simple story.
I completely agree.
You know, but again, and it had its own specific thing about, you know, corruption in the police force with Indonesia. So yes, that is there part of it, but like, it's also tailor built to apply that to any police force in the world, because they're all fucking corrupt, you know? Like, that general outline can be applied to any place, anywhere, anytime, you know, even. Because I saw some comments, you know, like they were complaining about the Raid remake. They're like, you know, what city would have a drug lord take over a whole apartment building without police interference? Like, that was like the '80s. That was the '80s in America.
Okay.
That was a crack epidemic. And more often, or more and more specifically, that was New Jack City. You know, when it's
right.
this is people are overthinking ways to like to hate this. It's so dumb. Like,
who would ever give a shit if they did that? Yeah, I would. Yeah. Oh man, this isn't what it's like in Detroit. Like, who cares? I'm fucking watching an action movie.
Yeah, same with the Train to Busan remake. That's also getting a lot of hate. You know, like somebody said the trains in Korea are high speed, high tech. You know, like they work. The trains work. How could you make that movie about a zombie, a terrible survival situation, work in America where the trains don't work? It's like, do you hear what you just fucking said? The trains don't work. I gotta escape the zombies by the train. The train doesn't work. That's a fucking movie. Like, you guys. Like, people try to make all these dumb excuses for why they. And again, they say this stuff in the name of, like, you know, representation or whatever the fuck. Like, which is a valid concern. But the way it's being applied to this outrage remix is like, it doesn't make sense. Like, for one, like I just mentioned, the Train to Busan being directed by Timo Tejanto. Like that's, you know, the guy who did like a headshot, who worked with Eco Waste and all these fantastic Indonesian films. So it's like, just people are just saying it by the principle alone, but like, they don't understand that. No, other people are getting paid. People are getting paid to, you know, like, people are getting work for these remakes too. You know, it's not just quote unquote greedy corporate executives, you know, or greedy Hollywood. People getting paid money to make these films, to be in this industry, to work. And also, like, that's the part that people don't recognize as well.
But yeah, so just, as a horror fan, which is a genre of remix, and to me is one of the genre's great strengths, is taking tropes, taking constructions that obviously work on people and affect people, and then interpreting them. Like, I want to see over and over again what your shot at Halloween looks like. I want to see what your shot at Miss 45 looks like. As long as, like, you know, I don't like the Rob Zombie Halloweens, but they are fucking Rob Zombie Halloween movies. You're not going to mistake those as coming from somebody else. And I do appreciate that. And I remember years ago, there was a long Collider interview with Joe Carnahan and Frank Grillo. And it's just like, they're in a fucking hallway sitting in chairs, like drinking wine, surprisingly. And just like just for the setup, that was the setup that Collider was like, yeah, let's go with this. And this abusive hallway lighting. And it was, they talk in that about like how they have plans. Like, Joe Carnahan was working up like an interpretation of The Raid. Like, he wanted to make his own version of The Raid, but he wanted it to be like gritty, knife fight, The Raid. I think he referenced like some knife fight in Band of Brothers. He was like, I want that for 2 hours. Like, and so that's not, Joe Carnahan's not running short on like action things he wants to make. Frank Grillo certainly is not in a limited scope of kinds of action movies that he will do, but they had a very specific thing. We're like, we love this movie. And the thing that really stirred up in us when we saw it was like, what if we did it in this one really specific way? And that's the beauty of a simple premise. Like, The Raid is, you can be like, but what if we do it in this really specific way? And you can build around that because it's all in execution. So if you execute on it, then fucking fine. Go for it. Like, do it right. Care about it. Be inventive. Take a huge fucking swing. Then I'm good. I'm there every time.
Well, yeah. And I would say specifically about this movie, because I know XYZ Films pretty well, and Todd over there. And I actually had a dinner with him and was just talking to him about The Raid. And I was like, you guys kind of like, if that movie had came out like maybe 3 or 4 years before, you guys would have made a fucking lot of money, huh? And
right.
He's like, yeah, they basically, like, if this thing had come out in the DVD market of like 2006, even just 5 years earlier, they would have made like $50 million on the movie,
but
it's like 2011. It just kind of like was in this no man's land where the fact that, like, yeah, I do think Gareth should get money on a remake. Like, I do think all those people should try to cash in, because traditionally when you make something with that big of a, you know, influence on the industry, you'd want to get rewarded for it. Now, I know Gareth, you know, he's doing great work, and he's now got this huge Tom Hardy movie, so he's fine.
Yeah.
But it was a long road, you know, like, it wasn't like there was
Hell yeah.
He's getting a lot of, I know he was supposed to do a Deathstroke movie or whatever. And so there's been some starts and bits to that career for someone who made such amazing works early on. But the other thing about this is that, like, you know, since I've been in this, I feel like the past 10 years, there's been a new Raid remake announced almost every year. So what are you going to get upset about until you actually see a trailer or something? Like, at least react to something at this point, because you're just going to get mad about announcements now. Like, who knows? I mean, literally, Patrick Hughes was announced in 2013 as the director of the Raid remake when it was, I think, at Screen Gems. And that was going to go right around the time of Beyond Skyline. And Frank Grillo was cast from Patrick Hughes' version.
Right,
I think he was going to be the Joe Taslim character of that version. That one fell apart. And that's why it was sort of a novelty for Beyond Skyline that we had Frank and Eco in a movie, because he had already been announced. And that was kind of fun. And they talked about, you know, the Raid a lot on set, and we were joking around it. And then that also, I think, influenced Frank into going after the rights for it with his company War Party, you know, a year or two after Beyond Skyline wrapped. Mm-hmm. They had it for a number of years. I mean, I don't know how much I could say, but I think pretty much like Cop Shop kind of hit the slot, and they were trying to get Jerry Butler for their Raid remake. And it ended up, you know, things shifting and it not working out, and they ended up doing Cop Shop instead. And now, you know, I think they're still trying to use the script that they had for the remake to be kind of an original, because it changed so much that it doesn't need to be. So to just get mad at these things when it's all in a state of flux, and it's all about people, like we're saying, just wanting to do work. Sometimes with these remakes, there's an incredible amount of awareness, and it makes it easier to get a movie made. And it's just that simple.
Yeah.
Oh boy. All right. I don't even know where to,
Well, I think you should talk about Red Hill, because you mentioned that on Twitter, and that's what I wanted to hear.
That's what I am going to do a little bit is because, again, you guys follow me, you know that I am in complete agreement with everything that everybody here has said. The one bit of ranting that I will do is one of the things that always bugs me about when people get pissed off about the remake, Liam, you hit one of them, which is I remember when a movie used to actually have to exist before we could get pissed off about it. But
those days, those uphill in the snow days, both ways.
But the other one is that there is such a paternalistic, moralistic bent to these conversations that drive me nuts, because it is important that we address the representation issues and stuff like that. But like, don't be, especially when people are the Train to Busan one was the one that just like straight up sent me, because people are like, how dare America remake a Korean movie? Have you seen how much American shit fucking Korea remakes? Shows are remakes of American fucking TV. The fucking Good Wife is one of the highest rated shows. The remake of The Good Wife is one of the highest rated Korean TV shows. Like,
can't blame them.
No, they remade Leverage, my favorite TV show of all time. Don't blame them. And you know what? They did it great. It was awesome. But it goes both ways. This isn't just an imperialistic thing that we are doing here, where we are coming in and taking all these movies from other countries. Like, criticize the things that deserve to be criticized. You're missing the target if you're going after this one. And that just bugs.
Yeah, you're bringing up a really important point that I think people, because I heard this before, arguments, you know, it's the what do they call it, the cultural
appropriation.
The cultural hegemony. Because traditionally, you know, American media being the biggest thing in export in the world, you know, it conquers over other countries like film industries. But that's just simply not the case anymore. You know, India, China, specifically, even Korea, like their film industries, their cultural output has grown exponentially over the past, you know, 10, 20 years. Like the K-pop is one example that's like, and the boy bands, like they're not dominating American music charts. Like that sense of American cultural hegemony is not the same, it does not exist the same way anymore that it does now. And even, you know, with Chinese box office, you know, like before Spider-Man came out in December, Chinese propaganda war film was the biggest grossing movie in the world. Like that, the cultural weight of American media and cinema is just not the same anymore. And also, and even in, with specifically, you know, this remake is being made by produced by Netflix. Like Netflix, I just remember, the article came out a few weeks ago about the rise of all the Korean stuff, like for example, the Squid Game being the highest grossing or the most watched TV show in the world now on Netflix. Like Netflix invested $500 million, would it be $1 billion in Korean content alone? Mm-hmm. Like this is like Mike just said, this is now an international game, you know, a finance thing. Like it's not just, you know, we're gonna take your shit over. Like people are there's cooperations and agreements being made bilaterally or multilaterally between these countries to get this stuff in front of as many people as possible. It's not just like you said, it's not just the empire taking over people's stuff anymore. It's way more complicated, way more sophisticated than that now.
Yeah, and more interesting too. You know, that cultural exchange is more interesting. We are getting better remakes of stuff, both from other countries remaking our stuff and our stuff remaking them. You know, if you're getting a movie with Teemo and being produced by James Wan and you're mad about that, come the fuck on.
Like, you can't be pleased.
Yeah, like, let's see. The dude who made Malignant and the dude who made The Night Comes for Us are going to make a movie together, and you're upset.
yeah, about, like, punching zombies and, you know.
Yeah, like, about zombie annihilation.
Yeah, about tying stuff to your arms and punching zombies in the face. Oh, God. I don't want to see that a second time. Like, give me a break.
You know what? That's it all. And I'll say that hope against hope. It would be such a baller move if they get Don Lee to play himself again.
And then I think Vice should be Madong Siak in the remake. I think you should be the man running through the train car while punching out zombies.
That was me in high school on a 4-train going to school every day. I don't have to commute. So I don't know, maybe we'll see.
You're the man for this job.
I was going to ask a question. This is like a Twitter engagement question for a podcast. Okay. Everyone here, I'll go around. You can remake a movie, any movie. What's your choice? Jordan.
Remake. There are certain things that I kind of like, I want to see remake, but like shot for shot, like don't change a thing. Like,
okay.
Yeah. But like, how would that like, and like, how would it exist in like present day? Like, oh gosh, what's the one I would go with for now? If anybody has a more immediate answer, John.
I have an immediate answer I want to remake a movie that is not great, but has a great title and has a great setup, and that's Tango and Cash. Tango and Cash would be like a fantastic remake. The title immediately puts a smile on my face.
It's a great,
you just get two action stars, each one saying the other's the second best cop in insert town, who both get, you know, set up and then sent to prison and have to team up. It's like you can remake Tango and Cash every decade.
You're right.
Like, so I just think. Yeah, that was actually one of those things when I saw like Under Siege was getting a remake. And I was like, that's great. And that's Teemo again. I was like, what other movies from that era would I like to see? And I'd like to see the one that like Tango and Cash is a fucking weird, like, you know, Sly Stallone's career is great because it's just like as soon as he has any bit of success, the movies go like they nosedive. Like the scripts nosedive as soon as he's on the upswing, and then he has to get fucking hungry again, and he has to get like work out, and he get to make something gritty, and then as soon as those are, you know, really well received and they do well, he immediately takes the script for like the big payday, Tango and Cash, and it nosedives again. That's his whole career. And so that's one of those ones that like he's coming up from a big win, and he takes this payday, but it still is a pleasurable watch because, you know, you got Jack Palance, just devouring scenery, Terry Hatcher in,
you know, Hatcher.
Terry Hatcher prime.
Woo!
And and Kurt Russell's like the mullet is you know, so it's definitely a fun one to watch, but like it was also like in that time where they're like, What's the third act of this movie? They're like, well, we got a truck. Yeah. The truck is the third act. Yeah, that's it. it's just a big truck and we're just going to fucking blow shit up with this truck. So yeah, that's what I think could be improved upon. And, you know, you could, that's like, I saw like Bautista and Jason Momoa are doing a buddy cop movie, like put them in Tango and Cash and let's go, you know, that's perfect.
I just remember there was one I was thinking of this exact conceit of recently. So I will go with the most recent one I was thinking about. And I finally watched Streets of Fire for the first time. Oh. And while I was watching it, I was like, I want to see like no dialogue changes, like 100% shot for shot, but just like with a present day cast, what would like even the same music? I want the same 80s glam aesthetic. I want the same like greasers and squares, like diametric split between the heroes and the villains. I want like, bring Rick Moranis back to play that character again. Like I was like, I want to see this for some reason, just with like, how does this everything about this is working exactly as it should. And Walter Hill, what a special career that was. I would just love to see the reckless abandon of a full shot for shock, same script remake, just with present day talent, with like fucking Hunter Schafer up there as the Diane Lane character, and be like, let's go truly bug fuck crazy in 2022 and make something with just like the right of like a deep, completely sincere, just the right amount of corny and over the topness, and just with like those meaty and melodramatic scenes to work through. I would love to see a one-to-one Streets of Fire with whatever you could scare up from like Gen Z.
Yeah, that would be fucking dope.
I want to know what Zendaya is going to do in that
movie. Who is going to be, who's going to replace Willem Dafoe is my big question.
Oh, man. Like what shoes to fill?
Yes.
What waiters, really? What leather waiters to fill?
Just put a bunch of these Cobra Kai kids in there and
hey, beat man, the shit out of each other. Yeah.
Hell yeah, man.
Oh, I thought of mine. So, I made a joke image about this, but I'm actually really serious. I mentioned it before just now. So Ma Rang Seok, Don Lee, I would do a remake of Shaft, and like with Don Lee as Shaft, but like not just like like, you know, because like people would say, why do we make Korean stuff? Why do we make black stuff? Or like, because that's always like, you know, are you gonna make a white Black Panther? You know, whenever you do like superhero, like, you know, race switches or whatever. But like, no, I want it to be Korean, but also like not in Korea. Like, I want it to be Shaft here in America, as a Korean American chef, because he's from here, like he worked here in America for a long time. Mm-hmm. He's not, so like I want to do that, like I want to see, but it would still be about like, you know, like actual like racial injustice, you know, fighting against the man, but he's just Don Lee with his giant meat hands, and like for all people, you know, but like
I love
like,
it
for Asian people, but also like, you know, he's people, the brothers love him too, you know. Hey Don Lee, if you're listening, the brothers love you, man. Brother, sister, like you the man, homie. We love you in the Eternals, you know, with the pie. Nah, I want to people, you know, because they say like you can't, because there's always the argument like all the race bending stuff, it'll break the raison d'etre of like these racially charged or racially empowering artworks, and I kind of want to test that. With something that says iconic like a Shaft with like an Asian guy. I'm like, that would be like an interesting test to see what will happen.
I absolutely too. Like one more thing I think about this every time I watch like an amazing Indian action spectacle. Like recently I went and saw, there was a theater out east of the city playing Suryavanshi, the new Indian action film in the cop universe. And I was like, God, I would love to see just some wild fucking director get carte blanche to make a 2.5-hour musical action movie and take it completely seriously. Not like, oh, this is gonna be like we're tongue in cheek, we're poking. No, like 100%. Oh yeah, of course we would put like giant song and dance scenes about love in the middle of this movie with this hard-boiled cop. Like that's not what you do. I would love to see just the American go. It could be a catastrophe. It could be sublime. But I want to know. I want like with a Liam with that in his hands. What is an action epic musical like war or Suryavanshi?
I think of Zac Efron. I just feel like he deserves to be in Bollywood action blockbusters. Yeah. And we don't let him shine the way that he should be able to shine.
I completely agree.
He has to wink and tell everyone he's in on the joke. It's like It's not a joke, baby. You're beautiful, Zach. You do.
I like, and The Rock is like really honestly built for something like this. Like the amount of like cheese in like the image of the, like, he is so perfect at that kind of wink to camera thing. The idea of him lip syncing a vocalist that's not him while he's dancing and singing to like a love ballad, but it's to his best friend who is his action co-counterpart. It's him and Zac Efron. I don't know. Like that is, I'm like, come on, America.
I don't want them winking. I want them like that's the thing I like about the Indian ones is that there
they're winking at each other in an implicit sexual way.
Yeah. But they're not winking to the camera in the Indian movies. No. They're like, we are this beautiful. And we're just not going to let you off the hook by letting you know that I'm in on the joke.
Yeah.
Because that makes everybody feel comfortable in the U.S. that you have to be like, oh, like Zac Efron, he's literally like Bruce Lee fucking ripped in Baywatch, but he has to let you know that he's in on the joke and that, you know, he's a tool. And it's like, no. He's awesome. Like, just deal with it. Just deal with it. Just drink it. Just drink it and swallow it. And everyone's like, no, I can't. It's too homoerotic.
I know. And I just want it. I want us to go full bore. I want to see it one time and watch it and just be like,
This guy's just going to look beautiful. And he's not going to let you feel good about yourself. You just have to deal with it.
I'd be all in for that. Like, what if La La Land was actually a bloody action movie?
Well, now we're talking. This is what we have to look forward to from the Jordanverse.
This is, get hyped, everybody. I'm serious.
Mike, have you thought of the perfect Hibachi Justice remake?
I don't know that it's perfect, but yeah, kind of. It's one that I've always thought it's... By a lot of people, it's considered a lesser of this director's filmography, but I think David Cronenberg's Scanners would absolutely update. You could remake the hell
take it.
Modern special effects, kind of go the full superhero route with it. So instead of just, you know, Michael Ironside looking really difficultly into the camera, you could actually have like stuff. But also, you know, not to get too political, but the idea of you've got this drug and you got a whole world of anti-vaxxers out there. The idea that, that this drug causes these mutations in people that give them special powers. But I would only want it if they...
There is a Daily Wire Ben Shapiro produced version of this movie. You are correct. It stars Gina Carano.
Mind you. Yeah, Kanye's already like fucking taking notes on it. Fuck you, Dallas, if you're listening, by the way.
Yeah, fuck you, Dallas, forever. And you too, Sonny Bunch.
But I think you could really, but you'd have to go all in on it. Like, this couldn't be some PG-13 thing. Like, I'd want it to be like Cronenberg did. You know, my first thought. In the mind, you know, we always say we want Liam to direct everything, but I actually think Lee Whannell would kill a
fun. He's a much better director than me.
I'm not honestly prepared to corroborate that statement.
Upgrade, he very much has that same vibe. Like you could, I mean, it basically would be Upgrade just with mental powers and stuff.
Yeah. Lee, you're right. That's actually, Lee would kick ass at that. And I think he has such a sense of joy in cinema. And I remember he was posting early on in the pandemic about like the comfort movies he was watching, and it came square out of the era from when you'd be watching Scanners. And I would absolutely, Lee Whannell is somebody who I'm like, you know what? I don't need the 80s nostalgia train to be like the only thing that we do. And I want the 2000s to have their time. And we make period pieces from like 03 and, you know, cropped belly bearing fucking sweaters, ribbed sweaters and bell bottom jeans and bronzer and all that shit. But
bundle tats. You gotta get those shit too.
Absolutely. I want to see, give Lee Whannell legacy properties from the 80s. I want to see that man fill all of our hearts with joy in translating those things to screen.
Yeah, and Scanners is a great watch if you haven't seen it. It does feel like a very dark, like one of maybe it is the first X-Men movie ever made. You know, it's a Canadian low budget dark X-Men movie, and it has great vibes, great practical effects. Yeah, highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite Cronenberg movies. But I know a lot of people consider it to be, you know, it's sort of his direct-to-video action movie. Essentially, it doesn't have the highbrow stuff that video.
That's why we love it.
Yeah, it's a great fucking watch. It's awesome. All right. Yeah. The one last thing, we got derailed. I do want to just shout out back to Patrick Hughes. If people haven't seen Red Hill, his 2010 debut, it is a nasty little piece of osploitation. Ryan Quantin plays a cop from the city. I can't remember if it's Sydney or Melbourne, who has had some shit go down. So he's moved to this small town. It's his first day. And they find out that this prisoner that the corrupt local police set up and sent to prison has been released and is coming back to town. And so it's very much kind of a High Noon type thing, where you've got this prisoner played by the great Tom E. Lewis, who passed away a few years ago, who's this sort of omnipresent threat throughout the whole movie, coming back to town. And you got Quentin as sort of our hero, but he's realizing that the people that he's working for are actually the bad guys. And Tommy Lewis's character is coming back to set shit right, essentially. And so there's a ton of tension. It's pretty short. It gets in and out. You know, again, if all you know is Ryan Quentin from like True Lie or True Blood, he's really fucking good in this too. So,
yeah, I'm always happy to see him. He's Ryan Quentin in fucking Hurricane Heist, Ryan Quentin in Knights of Badassdom. Like, this guy just kind of tends to fit wherever you put him. And I wish I saw more of him.
Yeah. Yeah. I like him too. He's one of those, again, he's one of those sort of blandly appealing white guys in that he's always good. He's never necessarily great, but he's always good, and he's always interesting to watch on screen. And here he's terrific. And so the reason I bring it up is because people are focused on Patrick Hughes doing the action, and obviously The Raid is a big kick-ass action movie, but there's also a lot of really gritty, nasty character work going on in there. I think Red Hill shows absolutely he can nail all of that aspect of it. You know, I'm not a huge fan of the action in like the Hitman's Bodyguard movies, but I don't think it's terrible, but he can absolutely nail the character work that he's going to need to. So if people haven't seen it, definitely do check out Red Hill. I don't know if it's streaming for free anywhere, but it's readily available to find. You can rent it or find it on Amazon.
I was going to say, it does say a lot to me that, you know, he was attached to this thing almost a decade ago and he fought to get back, and he got a second thing. I mean, that shows that, you know, that he definitely feels like he has this story in him. It's like, you know, it's very, very rare that you get a second chance at a property like that.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we are approaching 2 hours, so I think it's...
Can you just do one quick thing I was going to say, Mike, about the Nemesis, because I feel like we are Action Twitter's podcast, and there was this big outpouring of Nemesis and Albert Pune love that you should probably just address on that real quick before we go.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about that hell site that is Twitter, sincerely, is the viral movie watch. Our friend...
It's really fun.
Big supporter of the show, Billy Jarrett, decided to watch Nemesis. He had bought Nemesis from another follower of ours, and he decided to watch it, and that led Brandon Streisnig to watch it, and that led a couple of other people to watch it, and the next thing you know, everybody spent Friday night watching Nemesis and talking about how much they love the great Albert Pune. And as somebody who, you know, Pune is in my kind of like easily in my top five favorite directors of all time, it filled my heart with joy to see that. I don't know if you saw the update, but it actually made it to Pune on Facebook that we were all watching his movie and sharing the love. And he replied back and said, make sure to tell everybody, thank you. That's very
so sweet.
Yeah, it was, you know, Friday night, for all the shit that Twitter is, Friday night was one of the good ones. It was a lot of fun, and it was fun to just have these folks, you know, just watching this bonkers ass movie. I mean, Nemesis is bananas. It is a perfect example of getting the most out of your budget while sort of an auteurist view of how you want it to look. Because the thing I can say about Pune movies, ain't nobody making movies like Albert Pune. Like, no movies look like his movies. No movies are as narratively shaky as Because Keelan's all about the vibes, man. He's all about the vibes.
Well, you know, it's one of those covers. It's the VHS cover along with Fortress that I stared at the most but never rented. So I've still not seen Nemesis or Fortress. They were like, I'd rented every other action or sci-fi movie. And I would be like, I don't know about this. And so I wanted to do it Friday night, but I was already pretty lit up in the middle of Snake Eyes. So I'm going to catch it, I think probably tonight, and I'll tweet about that as well. But yeah
it's on Tubi. MVD put out a great Blu-ray of it a couple years ago, remastered and everything. But if you just want to check it out, it is on
Tubi. Coming through.
Coming back, bringing it all back together.
There it is.
Listen, hi-ya, you got competition for us now. We're not just going to sit here and, you know, just lay down. We got Tubi and Hiya vying for the action for everyone's seal laurels. Of approval.
You can't rest on your laurels here.
We're going up.
Got a bidding war going on here. Whole fucking bidding war. Everyone.
Look, we have a better poster than most movies at AFM.
You
better
right
fucking come
that.
To us. Talk you better come shit, to us right. With your wallet out.
No lies detected. For real. Shit, I'm hyped up, man. That's a great poster, man. Right? That's a great. Oh, god damn. We're so good. We are so talented and hot shit going on here in the podcast. Y'all don't even. We are, man. Look. You, all right, look, Mike. Take us out of here.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we again, thank you for the support for the poster. Jordan, let me go to you first, and please try and keep it somewhat brief. For those who don't know, she is literally the hardest working woman in podcast.
All right, so I should lead with the new podcast, which is actually on a network, Maximum Fun Network. It is called Feeling Seen. That is where the Michael Jai White discussion happened that we referenced before. It is, I have people who are generous enough to come on every episode, talk about the sort of character or characters that they felt alignment, a representation within film. And we talk too about the ways in which representation falls short and the ways that so many people have to headcanon themselves into places that they're not in order to find that sort of, to find those sort of mirrors back. And we have had some incredible discussions so far, and I'm really proud of it. There is, as always, the Disaster Girls podcast, where we are talking about disaster movies and also the TV show La Brea. We are definitely the official, unofficial show podcast for La Brea. We are having a lot of fun with that. There is, we are now sort of in between seasons on the Aughts Tyrion podcast. That's like the Aughts, the 2000s mashed up with Criterion, where me and my co-host, the director, Sam Weinman, talk about the intersection of politics and horror cinema around the millennium era. And we are always having so much fun with that. So those would be the big three. And then there is the intermittently updated whole movie podcast, where I have gone long on A Simple Favor and Neon Demon. I had an incredible conversation with the director of the excellent, very 90s, very steamy erotic thriller movie from last year, The Voyeurs. I highly suggest you all watch that and then listen to me and Michael talk about it. So those are the podcasts. You can always find me at the patreon.com/cruciola, where I'm obsessing over Yellow Jackets currently. And then, you know, hopefully with the iron, many irons in the fire get hot enough to start pulling them out in the writing and producing realm for you to start seeing things that come from that. So yeah, that is my as quick as I can rundown of all that.
Fantastic. And I did an episode on Disaster Girls for Independence Day, and it was
so
one of the most fun pods I've ever done.
I was the best.
Really intimidated because she had Paul Feige doing the previous Emmerich movie, and I was like, I actually did my homework and tried my hardest.
The Independence Day episode is one of our best. That was so much fun. A perfect guest, Liam.
Oh, thank you.
And funny, as we've discussed, funny.
Yes. That one I feel very proud of, and hopefully we'll have you back on and continue to cross over as Mike builds the greatest action hub podcast network the world has ever seen.
It's true. It's true. It's happening.
I'm available at Liam Odin on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Vice.
Yeah, I'm at the Twitters, Instagram, Letterboxd too. Even though I talk shit, most of like smart sometimes. So I talk like, you know, good, have good reviews. That's smart. And not being an asshole is good for you. So check out Letterboxd @Vice Victus and Twitters and all that stuff. Good for you. Good for the people.
And as always, you can find me on Twitter at Hibachi Justice, and you can, and I'll link Jordan, I'll link all your stuff in the show notes.
Thank you.
So make sure to specifically link that Disaster Girls episode and our episode that we did, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
On Adkins Undisputed. You can also follow me on Letterboxd at Hibachi Justice, where I'm not as smart and articulate as Vice, but I do at least try on Letterboxd. I talk a lot less shit on Letterboxd than I do on Twitter. So, yeah, you can always find me typically throwing out some sort of A24 meme that's going to piss people off on Twitter. So folks, this was awesome. Thank you so much, Jordan. We will definitely get you back.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a privilege and a joy. I have been so looking forward to joining you guys, and I am really looking forward to doing it again.
And Liam Vice, let's do this again next week, yeah?
Absolutely.